You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is Nancy Dalva, a writer well known in dance circles living in New York City. Nancy has had an almost lifelong relationship with the work of Merce Cunningham, and in 2012, 3 years after Cunningham's death, she was appointed the Merce Cunningham Trust Scholar in Residence. Nancy produced and wrote the scripts for the web series Mondays with Merce, and also produced the videos in the Mondays with Merce film library, all of which are available on the Trust's YouTube channel. Nancy's work with the Merce Cunningham Trust also involves her assisting scholars, researchers, dancers, and students, and she engages quite happily in the many associations, possibilities, and adventures Cunningham's work still presents. Her current project has her knee-deep in the beautiful footage captured at Cunningham's Dia Beacon events, which took place in 2007 to 2009. Cunningham's Dia Beacon events was part of the Merce Cunningham Dance Company's Hudson Valley Project, which took place in partnership with Dia Art Foundation, Bard College, and the John Cage Trust. So welcome to All Things Cage, Nancy. It's a pleasure to see you on this sunny and very, very cold Wednesday afternoon. How is New York?
Cold and sunny, Laura, and it's a pleasure to see you too.
How cold is it there?
It's warm in here and I haven't been out.
Okay, fine. Because it's like 20 here.
Well, I love winter.
You do?
I do. Would you like a quote from Merce Cunningham about winter?
Okay, what'd he say?
One day we're speeding through sunshine, and the next day we're slogging through snow, but it's a day we have to get through.
Very good. I always like one of Emmy's brothers lives in Finland, and they have a quote in Finland that I just adore. And the quote is, "There's no bad weather, there's just bad clothing." Isn't that nice?
That's perfect.
Anyway, it's a pleasure to have you. For our listening audience, Nancy and I have known each other a very, very long time, and we have had sort of counterpart relationships to the men that we have worked with. In my case, John Cage, and then Merce Cunningham. Nancy, not with Cage, but with Cunningham in very, very important ways that we'll get to talk about. Initially, when I wanted to talk to Nancy, I thought it would be really fun to really just talk about Jasper Johns and his show that's up in Philadelphia and New York City simultaneously, and how Merce and John Cage fit into that exhibition, but also in the life of Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg in general. But there are just so many things that I would love to talk with you about, Nancy. And one of them, let me see if I can get at it, and it'll get us started. So after John Cage died, I became very close to Merce, which had not been the case before John died. And in very large part, I became very close to Merce because he needed a safe haven. He needed somebody that he could vent at, rant about things, that he could just talk about his problems. He also, though, in equal part, desperately needed someone to talk to about his work. And I think that was you, primarily. And that became more the case as time went on, as after Cage died. What were you doing when Cage died? What were you doing at the foundation? No? So when did you come?
Very late 2007.
So 5 years later. And what brought you there?
A project that was proposed that didn't happen for various technical reasons, but that turned into the web series Mondays with Merce. But I had met Merce in 1977 and had interviewed him and seen him over all the years after that. And the first time I saw the company was 66. So my relationship to the work is lifelong, Laura. It's what Merce said about movement, I say about Merce's movement.
Right.
It's what's interested me all my life. I had a very active life of the mind, engaging with Mercer's work. I would look out the window at our family's farm and it would be raining into the lake. And it would remind me of Cunningham and Pondway, or everything reminded, all roads led to Merce. And I knew him, you know, well enough as an interviewer and a visitor, but I had never spent time at the studio. In the 1980s, Art Bukowski, who was then the executive director.
I remember Art well.
The Cunningham Foundation offered me tickets, as many as I wanted. Oh, he offered me tickets, as many as I wanted in 1977 when we met, to come to New York and see the seasons there. So I started going to every single season. And then in around 83, he said I could come to rehearsals in the theater. So I started seeing the work without the decor and without the music. And I learned about it the way Merce made it before the score was first heard, before the decor was added. So those were very important to me in terms of my understanding of the work. And in 2007, I went to work for Merce, essentially, and recused myself from writing about the company in any critical way.
Right.
And also pretty much gave my word to Merce that what happened at Westbeth would stay at Westbeth.
right. But see, this is kind of what I was talking with Nancy before we began today, that, you know, after John Cage died was really when Merce and I got close. And in very large part, the reason that it happened that way was that Merce needed safe haven people to talk to. That had always been John Cage for him. He would go home and rant, or he would go home and talk about his work and what he was doing and what he was thinking about and the problems he was having. And John would listen, like any good partner would do to another person. And when he lost John, I became that person at home, not in the office, because I was not really connected to the office. It wasn't until after John died, for example, that I ever took a class at Cunningham. And it just one day it dawned on me. It was like, Merce, I could take class, right? And he said, yes, of course, you know.
Just like him.
Yes, but even then that was slightly problematic, because I had a class and the teacher, I'm blocking her name. I can't remember her name, but anyway, she made some critical remark to me about my back. What she said was, oh my God, you have such a beautiful back. And I was very proud, you know, and I said, oh, thank you. And she said, it's a pity you don't use it. Now, why that was important was that I took it to heart. You know, I thought, okay, that's fair enough. I was a ballet kid, you know, everything was like ramrod, you know. But several people who were in the class with me went up to me and the teacher, more to the teacher than me, and said, do you know who you just said that to? That's Laura. That's like Merce's best friend. You can't do that, you know. And Merce loved it, of course, you know. But I think of you a little bit as you were the person that Merce had to talk to about his work, that you were interested in steps. You were interested in how he made things, what he was thinking about. And hardly anybody did that, Nancy, and I can tell you, that came to visit. People didn't talk about that stuff with him.
And I think there are three advantages that I've considered. And I wrote a monograph for the Aikens Press for the centennial, in which I was lucky to publish some of my interviews with Merce. And in preparing the pamphlet, I thought about our relationship. First thing that's important is that although Merce was the age my father would have been if he had lived long, and he was in his early 50s when he died, and Merce was now, of course, close to 90, I was the age to be his daughter, but I was also old enough and knew enough theater and dance history to know about things he was talking about that had happened an awful lot before. Mm-hmm. So one day I asked him about being at Brandeis to receive an award, and Twyla Tharp had been there. And I wanted to ask him about Twyla, and he said, yes, well, Twyla was there. but Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne were there. And I said, the Lunts were there? So then, you know, 5 minutes later, we were talking about a production of L'Apollon de Balac on Broadway starring the Lunts.
Right.
I could follow him.
Yeah.
And the second advantage was that I remembered things. So when he was talking about a dance, if he said, you know, the one with the rope, I'd say 5 Stone Wind. And we could keep going.
Uh-huh.
I could fill in the occasional blank, not in his memory of the work, but perhaps in some word or two. Uh-huh. And then there was just I just loved him.
Mm.
I really loved him. And I had not expected ever to have a relationship like that with him. And it was a great gift.
Mm.
And the gift really came from him.
No, it's true. It's true. He makes that all possible. He made that all possible. When did you start doing, well, first off, one of the most important contributions that you made was the creation and then the execution, the production, if you will, of the Mondays with Mirth programs, which were very much interview formats and with footage you would show, or there might be dancers that you would use, but you would actually illustrate that which the two of you were talking about. When did that start?
We started filming early in 2008, and I did nothing but film for 5 months. I didn't even try to make one because Merce was still walking well enough then. He was teaching sitting on an architect's stool, but he was quite mobile and he was doing what he called fuddling with his feet and demonstrating steps, and he was quite lively in class. And I wanted to get as much of him in the studio as I could. Mondays with Merce, to the Cunningham Foundation, Mondays with Merce was the end product. To me, it was just the tip of the iceberg of saving as much of Merce Cunningham as I could.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And I'm still making things out of it. YouTube channel has 70 videos that come from that time in the studio.
Yeah, but you know better than anybody, Nancy, that he really didn't like to be interviewed, by and large. Well, it changed because of you. And the reason I believe is that he trusted you. He trusted you to, you know, not ask him stupid questions, number one. He trusted you to know what he was talking about when he talked to you. And he trusted you to not go off on some tangent on things, that you stayed very focused with him and what he was trying to convey.
Well, Merce knew that it wasn't so much what I did as what I didn't do. You're mm-hmm. absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly asked about people, but I didn't ask personal, private life questions.
Right.
And I had always, and still believe, though I'm fascinated with anything anybody has to tell me about history, that everything that Merce wanted you to know about Merce is in his work.
Mm.
And that made it very easy. But
yes.
The other aspect, and this is a little presumptuous, but it's you and I'm going to share it, is if you talk to somebody for 45 minutes or so, every week, with the two of you sitting in armchairs facing each other, this is the emblematic relationship of the 20th century, which is that it's not psychoanalysis. I'm not an analyst, but it is a kind of mutual exploration of topics about one of the speakers.
Mm-hmm. Of course. But so I saw you as that. To him, you know, that he had someone to talk to. He had someone that was not the board. It was not the office staff. It was not the people concerned with all the day-to-day things about running a dance company, which he hated. It seems to me he hated that from the get-go. From the moment he started the company, he didn't actually enjoy the process of having a dance company.
What we have to do to understand that is to read your absolutely sensational collection of John Cage's letters.
Oh, the love letters.
No, not the local. Big book. That's personal. I mean, a giant collection of John Cage's letters. Yes. Because as you read those letters, you're realizing everything Merce Cunningham didn't do because John Cage did it.
Right.
It is in effect a kind of ghost portrait of Merce Cunningham, who is in there not doing things John Cage is doing. Right. So one of the best apprehensions I've had of Merce as a figure in real life is reading John Cage's letters. He's got a truck, he's got a car, he's got a contract. I remember Bill Anastasi told me that he realized that Merce had never actually installed the water bottle and the water purifier in his apartment ever.
That's probably true, because John was the cook, he was the bottle washer, he was the housekeeper, he was everything in the house. And Merce came home, you know, it was a ritual. Merce came home from work as if John hadn't been at work all day, but Merce would come home from work. He would complain about one thing or another that had happened in the office. And then he would go take a bath in his jacuzzi tub. And John would call the office and yell at whoever it was that had antagonized Merce during the day. So you can remember very well, you weren't there, but you can imagine very well the chaos that ensued when Cage died, because Merce didn't know how to do a lot of things. He didn't know really even how to take care of himself very well, because John had done all these things.
Did he ever pay a check, write a check or pay a bill, or did John just run that whole show?
No, Merce was pretty tight about his own money. He was, he wanted to take care of those things himself. But he wasn't an experimental cook. He didn't play in the kitchen. He didn't, he didn't have any motivation to do that. John always did that. But as time went on, Merce developed ways of adapting recipes for himself and would teach anybody who was interested. And all of that came from Cage. I mean, all of the techniques and all of the tactics of preparing a meal. So he learned, but at first he couldn't cope with real life because he hadn't really had to do anything.
For a long time, say, since about 1947.
Yeah. So you're looking at, what is that? 45 years.
It's a long relationship.
Everybody loved Merce. Everybody loved Merce.
Everybody, do you think everybody loved John Cage? I would have said everybody loved John Cage. Some people loved Merce.
Right. No, I meant it more as when people met Merce, they wanted him. Lou Harrison loved Merce. And he met Merce when John was still married to Xenia. And he was very angry that Lou was very angry with John because he had Xenia. Why did he need Merce too? Why couldn't he leave Merce for someone else, kind of thing? He was popular. Merce was popular.
I can only imagine.
And he was cute. He was John's 10. I used to say was John. I even asked John that question, whether or not Merce was his 10.
And as in a Barbie doll, a Ken doll?
No, 10, the number 10.
Oh, 10. I think you'll need to edit that. I heard you say Ken.
Oh, no. Okay, well, we've edited it doing this. So yeah. A 10 is really handsome person. A really handsome guy is a 10. Goes for a woman, too.
I see.
So they were good. They were good for each other, but that it was not always a bed of roses. Their relationship together.
I'm aware of that.
Yeah. Anyway, so you started doing these programs with him, which were enormously successful.
They have been. They were difficult to finish because, first of all, it was an open-ended project, and I was not trying to create a history for the future. The purpose of it was to document what Merce is working on at the time, almost to be in the room with him in the moment. And this was the reason, Laura, I think that the project appealed to him the most at the beginning, was that I wasn't asking him about Martha Graham every 20 minutes.
Right.
I was asking him what he was doing now and next,
right,
which is what interested him most. However, it doesn't create a great overarching historical structure. It just creates being in the room in the moment. And after episode 7 of the 16 was the last episode, was 7. It's called Events. It was made about the events at Dia. It was the last one before Merce died.
Uh-huh.
And then on the Monday, the evening of the day after Merce died, everybody came to the studio, and Robert Swinston was going to teach a 6 o'clock class. There are 100 people there, former dancers, people who knew Merce. And I managed to convince the piano player to agree to be filmed. And we threw a camera up and we have the video, the complete video of that gathering of everybody.
Hmm.
Everybody came back to West Beth. Everybody just, the doors were open. People just streamed in.
Right, right. Who was the piano player? Was that Pat?
No, if it had been Pat, it would not have been a problem. It was a Russian pianist, no longer alive, who was, it's way off topic. He had just felt a certain sorrow, I'm going to say, that he had never played for Merce's classes. But the only pianist who ever played for Merce Cunningham was Pat Richter.
Right.
And when Pat Richter was not available, there was no music. Okay. Merce just snapped and clapped. It wasn't that he was interested in having an accompanist. He was interested in having Pat Richter.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's a side issue. At any rate, we got to do it. And then 2 weeks later, we took our camera crew to Rockefeller Park for the River to River Festival, which was the first event after Merce died. And he had worked on it, but had not lived to see it. And there's a wonderful woman who named Kathy Richards who had worked.
I remember Kathy very well.
Foundation before I was there.
Yeah.
Whom I come to know. And she said something amazing to me, which I'm very grateful for to this day, and which I never would have really thought about because I would have felt it was overreaching. But I was walking away from the park and she said, "You're going to keep going, aren't you?" And I said, "I don't see how I can." And she said, "You have to. You saved him for us." I thought, well, I guess I did. So I kept going.
And we left
years, 10 years later, close to 10 years later, a few years ago, with my wonderful then associate Kevin Carr, we looked at all the footage, all 400 camera hours. And the first thing I looked at was Merce to see if I'd missed anything. And there was actually nothing usable left.
Really?
Every single bit of footage got into Mondays with Merce.
Wow,
the last episodes were all designed about what I had from Merce. And then Neil Greenberg, twice, or Gus Solomons would come in, or Val de Setterfield, and talk around what I had.
Right.
To make an episode. But all of it was based about what I had from Merce already.
Right.
And what can we spin out of that?
Right.
But I was so pleased that I used it all.
What was the venue? What was the first venue for Mondays with Merce? How were they seen? Who was the audience?
Oh gosh. Honestly, I don't think there was an audience so much as a desire to fulfill a grant that had been made many years previous and that was now due. So we had to produce something. The original notion was to have Merce's classes streamed live on Mondays.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
This tied into this hope John Cage had that Merce could do things more virtually and be home more. So it's all from that era, Laura.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gone to see Trevor Carlson about something else. And he said, oh, you didn't want to do that, but I have a project for you. So he asked me to look into doing this. I'm a writer. I never produced anything. I didn't know anything about video, nothing. It's typical to me of how everything happened around MERS, that he opened doors and you just walked through them and learned things. You learned on the fly. If you knew the material, you could learn the other stuff.
Right.
And the advantage was that I knew the material. Mm-hmm. I had that was what I brought to it. That and that I really was thrilled to get into Westbeth. It was as if I'd been looking at a beautiful clock, and I got to go around the back, open the door and walk inside it and see how everything was made. So it wasn't practical, to use one of Merce's great words, to do the live stream. Just the cost of bringing up the Cat 5 line from the lobby to the studio on the 11th floor was $75,000 in 2008. There were some problems. So somehow, and I don't know how, I invented Mondays with Merce. I ordered a book from Amazon on overnight, Laura, called Storyboarding for Dummies. Because Elliot Kaplan, who was involved with launching the very beginning of the project for just the first episodes, said, I need storyboards. And I thought, huh, what are those? So that's how it started. It wasn't that I had any great, I still don't have any great ability to make these things. It was that I had the dancers, I had Merce, and I had cameras.
Right. And you wanted to talk with him. I know. I can tell. Everybody could tell.
I still would like to talk to him. And that is the part of the project that really, I feel, I read the transcripts. Why didn't I ask the follow-up? I see so many spaces I would like to pursue now.
Yeah. Well, a girl can't do everything.
On the other hand, sometimes Merce would say something and I would know not, but he'd said all he meant to say. That it might have been more than he meant to say. And he certainly wasn't going to say anything else.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, it was like we were talking before, that your ability to do these programs with him had as much to do with what you wouldn't do, that he could trust that, than what you would do, which he could trust also. But he knew that you wouldn't take him down some road that he didn't want to go down and put him in an awkward position. That never happened, did it?
Never. The other thing that was important, which you will actually have a much more profound experience of than I did, was how to keep going as his strength waned and his memories grew more distant and his interest wasn't perhaps in the moment the way it had been. Mm-hmm. And that I'm not sure about. I'm just thinking on my feet, except I'm sitting down. I realized that when everything else wasn't sparking Merce's enthusiasm, technique sparked his enthusiasm. Right towards the end of our interviews, and the last time I interviewed him was 4 weeks before he died. So he came in and he said, oh, what are we going to talk about today? And I said, fifth position, Merce. We haven't gotten to fifth. We've only gotten to first and second, but let's skip because fifth is your favorite. We'd be off to the races talking about fifth position.
Exactly.
He could talk about the fundamentals always applied.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. No, I know that about him, but I just know that I guess in my position with him, what I got to see was people visiting with him and talking with him. So people came over all the time and I was kind of the host, you know, because Merce just wanted to sit there and be the king, you know, and people would come over. So I would pour the wine and I would make the appetizers. And I got to watch people talk with him. And I was always astonished at how few people talked to him about technique, how few people actually got into the nitty-gritty of dance, which is why he was doing what he was doing. You know, that was why he was doing it. It wasn't because he had this innate love of having a dance company. He liked the power. He just liked technique.
He liked make power, I think.
No, terrible.
He liked the power of making the work. I don't think he liked the overarching power. I think Nurse made dances until the late 70s or early 80s because he liked to dance. Mm.
He told me that he started a dance company purely because he wanted to dance his own dance.
Yeah. There you are.
So it was quite challenging on him when he was no longer able to really move, because
he had some other things that kept his interest. Mm. I think the computer program, the Teclis Shiphorse,
now
called Life Forms, and called Dance Forms, that she developed with him.
Right. Also filmmaking. And also filmmaking.
From the beginning of the time Charlie Atlas walked in with a camera, mm-hmm. Merce was interested in filmmaking. I would like to say two things about Merce's powers that occur to me right now, Laura. I realized the first one when I was at Dave. He did a series of articles with a publication called Dance Inc., published by Patsy Tarr, that then became Twice. And there were photo shoots specifically for these issues. And I got to go to the photo shoots, which was very exciting to me. And I was in Westbeth watching him stage a photo shoot. And Merce was, if you think of Westbeth as a shoebox, Merce was at the short end of the shoebox watching. And the dancers were on the long end. So he was watching them from the side and the camera was across from them. Mm-hmm. And he was directing the photographer. And I said to him afterwards, "You're sitting over there, but you can see through the camera." And he said, "Oh, yes, yes." He could send his eyes around the room. He could see from any angle. He was like, he had a bird. He could fly around like a bird somehow visually. Mm. And then he was making a dance, nearly 90, his last dance, for 12 dancers. And Dylan Crossman was in the company when it was the Rugs, and he was making it on his repertory understudy group of four. Told me a story when we were on tour in Chicago. Merce was looking down one day for a very long time, and the dancers became a little concerned. So the other three pushed Dylan forward and said, "Go see if he's okay." So Dylan walked over to Merce, who was sitting at his desk with his head down, seemingly sunk in some sort of reverie, and said, Merce, are you okay?" And Merce said, "Oh, yes, I'm just thinking about the others." And when this dance came, this company, he set it on the company. I said, "Merce, the whole time that I was sitting in the room with you looking at four dancers, were you seeing 12? He said, "Oh, yes." Hmm. When he made Blue Studio with Nam June Paik, mm-hmm. there are different Merces all laid into the same scene.
Wasn't that Charlie?
That's Nam June.
It was.
Blue Studio, I think. Let's check. But Merce said to me, we were talking about it, and he said, "Well, you know, it got harder and harder as I went along because I had to remember where the others were." And I said, "You mean the other yous?" And he said, "Yes, I had to remember where I'd been so I didn't overlap."
I see. It's so cute.
So these are examples of how I became aware of the way Merce Cunningham experienced the world. It was as different from the way I do as the way a snake is different from the way I do.
Right.
He just had powers of, he had mental and visual powers that were just of another order. Mm. Mm.
I had that experience.
People who play 40 games of chess in their heads.
Right. Did you see the movie, The Queen's Gambit?
Not yet.
Oh my God, you have to see it. It's so wonderful. Speaking of seeing chess games in your head, it's really good.
of Merce and John is them playing chess in the airport.
Right.
It was a little traveling game.
Yeah, yeah. We have boxes of them here at the Cage Trust. You know, boxes of little portable games, little magnetic portable games, little, you know, ones with little sound effects, all kinds of little chess games.
Laura, can you talk about chess and the number of squares on the board and its correspondence with the I Ching and that whole world of 64 squares and the number 64?
No.
Seems to me, does it have any significance in John Cage's work?
I don't understand your question. Of course it does. What? How would it not? I mean, he used the I Ching. He didn't use the I Ching because it had 64 squares, but it did have 64 possibilities. Yeah, just like a chessboard has 64
faces. Yes, 8 times 8, 64.
Yeah.
Yes, I thought that was the and then when Merce made Ocean, he was also using the same sort of scheme.
Yeah, and he put, that was the scheme for the floor, was it not? For the whole, the round stage, there were 64 squares. So it was a big square made into a round space that itself held 64 spaces.
Can we use this as a segue and go to Philadelphia for a minute?
Of course,
of course. To the Philadelphia Museum of Art, where Duchamp's, Marcel Duchamp's The Large Glass, or The Bride Stripped Bare by Her Bachelor's Even, which is what we call it in English, but I have retranslated it because I think it should be translated The Bride Stripped Bare by Her Own Bachelors.
I see. Uh-huh.
And how it came to be because of chess playing that Jasper Johns made decor for Walk Around Time.
Uh-huh.
out of the large glass. But the question I had was, how often did Marcel and John play chess? Was it often?
I don't know, really. I mean, that's a relative question. They played chess whenever they could, I can tell you that, because they were both absolutely addicted to the game. And John would play not only with Marcel, but with Tini. When Marcel was still living, the three of them would play.
And then Alexina Duchamp, his wife.
Yes, Alexina, yes, otherwise known as Tini.
So that people know who Tini is.
Yeah. And then after Duchamp died in 68, and Tini lived on for a number of years after that, Cage and Tini would get together and play chess as frequently as they could.
Right after the premiere of Walk Around Time, must have been close.
Yeah,
premiered in 68 in Buffalo.
Yeah,
in March.
Yeah, and 68 was also the year that John Cage and Duchamp played Reunion, which was the performed chess game with an electrically amplified, not an amplified, but an electrically active chessboard.
Generated.
The sounds were generated by the raising and the lowering of chess pieces onto this specially made board. That was also in 68. So it's a very big deal. And I'm not sure, but I think Cage's father may have died in 68. I'm pretty sure. So it was a big year for all of them. It was a very big year.
Also the year that men first walked on the moon, wasn't it?
It could be. It was in the 60s, for sure. We were around. Don't pretend we weren't.
Well, that's how I remember seeing the full moon that night.
I don't think that Merce was as enamored with chess as Cage was. I don't remember Merce, you know, really wanting to play. But John could entice him, you know, to play in the airport, to play, you know.
Something to do.
That's exactly right. You even said that like Merce. Well, it was something to do, for heaven's sakes.
Oh, there are many people who do wonderful imitations of Merce Cunningham. Mark Fard is the best one, but
really?
Michael Cole's really good too.
Uh-huh.
It's funny, people slip into his voice sometimes. You can hear it underneath. During Merce's centennial, I got took myself as, to as many places as I could where Mirce's work was being performed by a great many different dance companies. So I spent a lot of time in Paris, and I went to London for an afternoon to see an event Jeannie Steele staged. I went to Washington. I saw as much as I could. And I guess I was searching, answering the question I used to ask people after Mirce died, which is, where is Mirce for you now? And my feeling was that Mirce would be in the work, which of course he always is. Hmm. What I discovered that was so marvelous, Laura, was that Mirce was everywhere his dancers were, because his words came out of their mouths. When Cedric Andrea was talking to his students at the Conservatoire in Paris, which he now directs the dance program, he's giving them a pep talk in French. It was Mirce giving a pep talk, or a class would be taught. And it was watching Mirce's dancers teach technique class. I watched Jennifer Goggins teach the Paris Opera Ballet. I saw Cheryl Therrien come back and join her co-dancer Tom Cayley and teach technique class to Tom's company. And they danced a combination across the floor together. So they were flying across the floor together, and that's where Mirce was. It was in them doing the work still.
Interesting. We always, I like to say that the John Cage Trust was formed on one really central idea, and that was the need and desire to know, what is John Cage doing now? You know, what is he doing now?
What is he doing now,
Laura? He's waiting out the pandemic like the rest of us.
Was he a homebody?
Was John a homebody? I suppose you could say he was, but he had a huge sense of responsibility to the world, that was from a very, very young age. So, you know, he was the guy that said, if you build it, I will come, you know? And when people did performances, he was constantly bouncing around the world because he felt responsible that he had made something, they fulfilled the performance of it, and he had to be there, you know? So he wasn't an easy traveler on the planet, if you know what I mean. He wasn't excited by travel as time went on. Who would be? You know, he was getting older, just like Mirce, you know. But he enjoyed being home a lot. He loved cooking, he loved gardening. These were his favorite things. So those required being at home.
When you talk about him as a citizen of the world, I don't feel much correspondence to Mirce Cunningham, but when you talk about his going to see the work, Mirce was in the wings long, long, long after he'd left the stage. He went with his company. He watched every performance.
Right.
He was present in his work until it just became impossible.
Right. We all thought that, you know, when he injured himself, when he got the leg. Remember when he got, you may Seattle. Not have been there by then.
No, it was in Seattle during the earthquake.
Yes, that's exactly right. And this was like 2006.
It was the premiere of, Loose Time.
Yeah, but that was when he developed this, I forget what you call it, on his leg, like an aneurysm.
He had a blood clot in his leg.
Exactly. And he couldn't go home. So the company went on to Arizona. Ironically, I was living in Arizona and was so looking forward to seeing Mirce and the company. And Trevor called me and said, can you come to Seattle? No, it wasn't Seattle. It was Oakland. It wasn't Seattle. And Trevor said, Mirce has to stay here for weeks because he can't fly and he can't travel. Would you come here and be with us? So we both, I flew down and we were or up from Phoenix and we were at the Claremont Hotel. Yeah, Claremont. Anyway, yeah. And his company went on without him. It was heartbreaking for Mirce.
He really was a always in that wing. Mm. The same way George, that is something he had in common with George Balanchine. And they stood in the same wing.
Really?
Yes.
Nice. All right, Nancy, we're going to have to wind up soon. Is there anything, we haven't talked at all about Jasper's show. Do we want to?
I think that these two shows of Jasper's, I'll try to be really quick.
Okay.
They are fabulous retrospectives. They are entirely different because their curators are so different. It's Scott Rothkopf here in New York City, and the Whitney show, if you're here, it's hung very musically. It's as if a great jazz musician had installed the show. And when you walk in, if you go on the elevator on the far right as you get off, the first thing you see is Jasper's lithograph called Ocean of Merce, both young, probably in his 20s, and the Annie Leibovitz photo of him in old age.
And do you have one of those? I have one.
I do.
Yeah, Merce bought me mine.
Yes. We all come by them one way or another. So I am lucky to have one. And it tells you that Jasper and Merce were on this journey together all the way across their lifetimes, which is this ocean.
Very nice.
And on the water, in the studio on the water, are hung the numbers portraits, which have Merce's foot in them in the upper right corner, and then a deconstruction of them. This late life platinum, it's titanium, I think, cast that was made. Originally, Jasper Johns had wanted to do it through a lost wax process that didn't work, but he had broken pieces of the lost wax castings, and he made these smaller versions, which are fantastic because you can see all the detail on eye level that you would only see if you could climb up on a ladder and get close to the big ones. I feel, Laura, that these are the perfect portraits of Merce. Everything is embedded in them, the newsprint and everything, and the clues, the keys, every real keys. There's a lot of subliminal information. But Merce made his dances to his own counting, his own phrases. So when you see numbers, it's Merce's music.
That's nice.
Merce said that music, he said to me, Merce said, about the time of the centennial, I think, not centennial, the 50th anniversary of his company, rhythm is time cut up. So I thought these were wonderful portraits. Of course, Jasper Johns was concerned with numbers anyway, but they're pretty good portraits of Merce's mind in a way.
Right.
And I love them for that reason. Philadelphia is an overarching magisterial presentation where you go through Jasper Johns' career room by room, and it all accumulates around you until you have a sense of a vast, let's call it a repertory. And in it, you see repeating figures and concerns reiterated over the years in different ways. This is exactly Merce Cunningham's method in choreography. And you can see a likeness of mind in regard to their material, which I discussed with Merce. And he said of Jasper Johnson, I wish I had it in front of me, but it is, he's concerned with the materials of painting. And I said, just the way you are concerned with the material of movement. And he said, yes.
So
that's the Cunningham element in the shows.
Nice. Very nice. Thank you. We always enjoyed having, it didn't happen often enough, but whenever Jasper would come to dinner, after John died, it was always so wonderful because Jasper clearly had great affection for Merce, and Merce had great affection for Jasper. You know, I inherited so much stuff of the apartment after Merce died. And my absolute favorite thing of all the things I inherited was this papier-mâché tiger that Jasper had bought for Merce, and it has, you know, the head, it's a bobblehead character, kind of, it's about this big, maybe, but it's a tiger, a black and orange tiger, and it's just adorable. And those are the kinds of things that Jasper would kind of bring with him whenever he went, were these lovely, strange objects, you know. Nancy, we have to wrap up. Thank you for doing this with me,
It was really way too flattering, but it was very kind.
No, it's very nice. And I'm glad to see you. Doesn't happen often enough right now.
It's nice to see you too.
Okay. Send me your bio, please.
Yes. Goodbye, lovey.
In the spring of 1981, during a residency at the Walker Arts Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, choreographer Merce Cunningham and composer John Cage sat down to discuss their work and artistic process. As frequent collaborators, Cage and Cunningham pioneered a new framework for performance. Their novel approach allowed for mediums to exist independently, or rather to cohabitate within a performance, thus abandoning the centuries-long codependent model of dance and music. Cage and Cunningham go on to discuss the methodology and motivations behind chance operations, a term used to describe artistic decisions based on unpredictability. Wanting to free himself of his likes and dislikes, Cage describes how Zen Buddhism influenced his work, leading him to use tools of chance. These new methods, adopted by both Cunningham and Cage, albeit with subtle distinctions, overturned a whole foundation of thought around music, movement, and the process of creating art. We've only time for an excerpt from this conversation, which happily may be heard and seen in its entirety on YouTube.
Your collaboration together over the years has been quite unique in that it's a choreographer, dancer, and a composer, musician, putting together works, but they're not really related to each other. Could you talk a little bit, maybe Merce, you could start off, how this collaboration got started in the specific form that it's in?
Well, it was in the middle 40s, and John had come to New York. I was already there, and we decided to give a program together, and for which I would make the dances and John would write the music. John had already talked about the idea of having a music which was not dependent upon the dance nor the dance dependent upon the music, but which were separate identities which could, in a sense, coexist. And we worked at that time within something which he called a rhythmic structure. That is, we thought the common denominator between the two arts was time. And he had devised a form called rhythmic, which he called rhythmic structure, actually, within which we worked, where we agreed upon certain structure points, but within those structure points, the time within the structure points, we were free to do as the dance went and as the music might go. And more or less the first time that we began to work together, and then we've continued, and now the structure points in a way have disappeared, or it's a little bit like instead of going from Minneapolis to St. Paul, you go from Minneapolis to the moon, and there's a different thing about time.
It's less like an object and more like the weather, because in an object you can tell where the boundaries are, but in the weather it's impossible to say when something begins or ends. We hope that the weather will continue, and we trust that our way of relating dance and music will also continue. It's not starting from an idea, not starting even from an expression of the same feeling, nor an exposition of the same idea, but rather simply being together in the same place and the same time, and leaving space around each art, so that neither art has to glue itself to a particular. There are exceptions, of course. In Merce's solo tango, which was performed here yesterday, there are two points in the dance that we try to have the sound specifically related to. When he throws the towel down on the floor, immediately the loops which have been playing in my vocalizing stop and the television begins. And then when, a half a minute later, when he comes to the front of the stage and points down, the television stops and my drinking a cup of water with the throat microphone on starts. So that dance is not so much like the weather as it is a dance that has three parts, or at least the music has three parts. You, maybe you have more parts in the dance.
No, the dance is three. Three parts.
In general, though, you basically the only communication that you have with each other in doing the sound and in doing the dance is just a time frame. You just say, it's going to be this amount of time. And
that was the practice anciently in India. Instead of having two arts, dance and music, they had an art called Sangeeta, which was dance and music together. And they had a rhythmic structure which was called tala, but they improvised in that, in the talas. In the West, we've never had a, except perhaps in the Middle Ages, an idea about a theory of rhythm, so that it, that left it possible for us in this century to start thinking about time. And the more recently, in 1950, when the use of magnetic tape for musical purposes became generally usable, we began to see a close relation not only between movement and music, but between space and time.
Who normally provides the initiation for a dance and music piece? Do you, Merce, do you say that, okay, this piece is going to be 10 minutes long, and then John goes off and composes something and you do your dance?
We don't even state the time length.
Oh,
at
you
the beginning.
Don't?
No.
Often with the composer, he will ask the how long the dance is, and then if I know, I'll tell him. But if I'm working on it, I have perhaps an approximate idea of the time, but nothing specific. And so that even that can be left free, in other words. If he wants to know exactly, of course, I will tell him. I'll tell him whatever he wants to know, but I try not to put anything in his way.
Because at the point where you're deciding that you are going to do a dance, you don't exactly know what it's going to be anyway.
And also, some of the dances that I make are choreographed that they could, in a sense, go on and on. And I simply have to choose a point when I'm going to say, well, this is the end of this dance. Torse, for example, is in its entirety 55 minutes long. And the dancers have only done it once in an event, and that was enough. I wouldn't ask them to do it again. That was very difficult. And we ordinarily do it in three parts, the first part on one performance, the second part, and so on, the third section.
There was a misprint once in a criticism. I was at a program, and the writer said that Taurus was 55 minuets.
Well, to talk to you. Good.